The time is about 11 minutes after 3, and those present are Representative Cisna, Representative Faircloth, Representative Gardner, Representative Paul Seaton.
It's after lunch.
Representative Edgman and Representative Roses and myself, Wilson. And we've got a lot to do today because we have before us Eddie Jeans, and he's with the Department of Education, and he's going to attempt to explain to us how the foundation formula works and what all goes into it and how it changes along the way. So it's quite a journey, so I think we'll just start right in, and Representative Mark Newman has just walked in the room. So we have everyone here, which is wonderful. So Eddie, if you'd like to start, just go ahead. And as we go along, please stop us anytime and ask questions. That's the only way that you're going to learn is to by asking questions and make it clear, because when we go on to the next, I always say factor in the formula, everything changes or something. So we'll just turn it over to Eddie and see what we have to see here.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Eddie Jeans. I'm the Director of School Finance for the Department of Education. And today we're going to discuss the public school funding formula. And in your packet, you'll have the PowerPoint presentation that we're going to go through today, as well as a document that's titled Public School Funding Program Overview, updated January 2007. I would encourage you to share that with your staff. This is a really good resource document. My staff and myself can answer just about any question about the foundation program that you may have utilizing this document. So please share it with your staff. And as Representative Wilson said, please stop me if you have questions. It's much easier to address them when we're at that point in the presentation. And so with that, Madam Chair, the current public school funding formula was adopted under Senate Bill 36 in 1998, and it was implemented in 1999. And the public school funding formula law is defined in Alaska Statute 1417. The presentation will provide an overview of the calculations of the adjusted average daily membership. We refer to that as the ADM, so you'll see that throughout the presentation. We'll discuss the calculations of basic need, and this is the entitlement. How do we get to what districts are entitled to? Once we've determined what the entitlement is, we determine who's going to pay for it. In our public school funding formula, we have a required local contribution, we consider federal impact aid, and then whatever's left over is the state's contribution to education. There are additional funds above basic need, and we'll discuss those, and in the end, we'll discuss the components of state aid. The average daily membership is a 20-day count. During the month of October, and it's the fourth Friday in October, and it's based on enrollment. Many people think it's based on attendance, but in our state, it's based on enrollment. So we do a count of the students enrolled in the district during that 20-day period, divide it back by 20 to come up with the average daily membership. The reports are due to the department within 2 weeks after the 20-day count period. And we also collect student projections for the upcoming school year at the same time. And that's how we build our budget that's before you, is based on those projections. Who qualifies as a student? These are defined in statute as well. A child who is 6 years of age before September 1 and is under the age of 20 and has not completed the 12th grade is considered of school age. When I say has not completed the 12th grade, many of you probably know that we have high school graduation requirements. They have to meet so many course credits. But in addition to that, they have to pass the high school qualifying exam. So many students may finish their course requirements by the age of 17 or 18, maybe haven't passed one piece of the high school qualifying exam. This allows the state to provide funding to the school district to provide remedial sources, classes to those students until they pass the high school exit exam. So completing the 12th grade really has two pieces, two steps to it. A child who is 5 years of age prior to September 1, beginning the following the school year, is eligible to enter kindergarten. And then children with disabilities that have an active IEP, individual education program, may enter school, and I guess I kind of said that backwards, because when they enter school, then they get the IEP, at age 3, and we continue to provide funding up through the age of 22. Or up to 22, excuse me, not through.
Representative Newton.
Thank you, Chair Wilson. Eddie, on the ADM reporting, I've talked to several folks, and we have such a transient population in some schools, and that changes a lot. Is there any reason or particular reason why ADM isn't calculated twice a year? Or, and I'll just ask my part two of this question.
Okay.
Is I've also had discussions with other folks about if ADM changes, or could there be a certain percentage of the foundation formula that's given to schools, 80%, say, and we find out that the ADM has changed because those students went to another district. Now that other district, District B, has more students than they received funds for. District A has more funds than they should have got for the kids they've got. If at the end of the year, or towards in the middle of March, say, an ADM was done, so that we could kind of equal that out. Do you understand that, or what's the feasibility of something like that happening?
Thank you, Representative Newman. First of all, prior to this funding formula, there was an optional account in February for school districts that had an increase in student population, and that allowed them those additional resources that they needed because of their student population increases. During the debate on Senate Bill 36, the legislature elected to remove that option. There was also discussion about averaging the two counts. And I think what it really boiled down to is school districts have to enter into contracts with teachers. The contracts are for the entire year. The October count allows them to basically have the maximum student count for the most part. For hiring their teachers and budgeting for that those expenses throughout the school year. So right now, as it's written, we have the one count. It would take a statutory change to do something else. And I think part two of your question is there a mechanism for the money to follow kids when they move between districts? And under the current funding formula, there is not. But it's an option.
Could you give us an example of how that option might work, or would you have a suggestion, Eddie? Or is it feasible, I guess, to look at 80 or 70? Or if you and I talked about that, could we go into more depth? Or not today, but is that worth pursuing?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, I'll tell you, it would create an additional burden on the department to track those funds and to track those students as they move through or move from one school district to another. We do have a student ID system in this state, and we collect individual student information based on that ID, so it is possible to track them, but that would require additional collection efforts throughout the year, and then, like I said, we would have to have a statutory change to allow us to adjust funding or to require districts to transfer funding to another school district at some point.
Unless that funding wasn't appropriated 100%. If it was 80% appropriation or 90% and then 10% allowed, towards the end.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, we do make monthly payments to school districts, so it's possible to make those adjustments. I think that the question is how many times do you want to adjust the revenue that's going to a school district when they've already built their budget and they've staffed based on that budget?
Thank you.
Okay, there are five steps to adjusting the student count, the average daily membership. The first step is to adjust it for school size. The second is to apply the district cost factor, And I'm going to ask you to hold your questions here because we're going to go through each one of these steps in detail. The next is we increase that product by 20% for special needs. Then we add in the intensive service count. We add to that the correspondence student count. And when we get to the bottom, we have the district's adjusted average daily membership. And this is the adjusted student count that is then multiplied times the base student allocation that's in statute to determine the entitlement for the school district. Now, before we get to the size adjustment, the first thing we have to do is look at the size of the student population within a community. And I'm going to skip over the first one here where it says ADM under 10, and I'm just going to jump down and I'll come back to it. A community with an ADM student population of 10 to 100, we fund that as if there's one school in that community. We combine the ADM and we run it through the size adjustment table, which we'll get to in a minute. If the community has 101 through 425 students, we fund them as if they have two schools. We split the student population into K-6, 7-12. In many of our communities, we have one large K-12 facility. In some of our communities that have had public schools for a number of years, you may actually have three public schools that's serving a population of less than 425, and Representative Wilson knows about that very well. Then once we get to a community of greater than 425, each school that is administered separately is adjusted independently. There's two exceptions to that rule, and that is if you have an alternative school with an ADM of less than 200 students. Typically, most people think of these as alternative high schools. Or if you have a charter school in your community, they have to have over 150 students to count as a separate school in that charter school. In both cases, if you don't meet the threshold of 200 or 150, we add that student population to the largest school in the district for funding purposes, so that the school does not get the benefit of going through the size adjustment table independently, and you'll see what I mean in just a minute there. For schools that are under 10, have fewer than 10 students, we add that to the smallest school in the district. And I believe the intent there was to try and give the schools districts as much revenue as possible for those very small schools. But I have to tell you that the first year that this law was passed, we had a Kodiak Island School District had two schools, one that barely had 10 students and one that had 7 or 8. And when you added the 7 or 8 to the 10, there was no additional funding for those 7 or 8 students. And you'll see what I mean when we get to the formula in just a minute. I'm going to use Nome City Schools as our example today. We are going to walk right through the entire calculation of the Nome Public Schools. And you can see here they have four schools in their district. They have the Nome Elementary School. They have Nome Belts Junior Senior High School. They have Anvil City Science Academy, which is a charter school. And then they have the Nome Youth Detention Facility. And I'll tell you, the detention facilities around the state, because they're state facilities, they are counted as a separate facility for funding purposes, because we're working basically under a contract with the school districts to serve those students.
And I want to make a comment here, because like my school in the town that I live in Wrangell, we have three schools: the elementary school, the middle school, and the high school. And because our numbers are under 450, we only get paid for two schools, even though we have a building supervisor in all three schools and things like that. So it makes it right. So right off the bat, there's not as much funding as a larger school would have, you know. So we're just on the first step here.
Madam Chair.
Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, Eddie, the Nome Youth Facility is I've got several, actually I think I've got four or five schools in my district. We've got North Star North Star School, we've got API has a school. All of those, are they treated in exactly the same way? McLaughlin?
Through the chair, Representative Sisna, McLaughlin is the youth detention facility.
Right.
The other schools are considered alternative schools, and we've actually have an agreement with the Anchorage School District that we count all those other schools that you mentioned under Whaley Center, I believe it is.
Okay, yeah. Okay, thank you.
Okay. The reason we have the arrow on this slide is you can see that the charter school has fewer than 150 students, and so the law tells us to add it to the largest school in the district. That happens to be the elementary school. The total population of Nome is 965 students. And I guess we can skip this slide because it just explains what I just did, that the charter school gets added to the largest school.
Madam Chair?
Representative Gardner.
On the preceding slide, why is it 0.08?
It's the average of days.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner. Very good catch, and I'll correct that slide.
Then I am following. Okay.
You are following.
Okay.
This was a test. You passed the math portion of the high school qualifying exam.
Of course.
Okay. Okay. Here's the school size adjustment table that I was discussing earlier. And what I'd like to point out for you is you'll see for a school that has 10 to 20 students, we have a base allocation of 39.6. And this is an adjusted student count. The 39.6 gets carried down to the next level for 20. And then for every child above 20, you'll see we're going to add 1.62. So if there was 21, we would have 21 here minus 20. 1 times 1.62 would be 1.62, and we would add that to the 39.60. This formula carries on down, so at 30, you would generate 55.80, and for every child above 30 in a school, we would add 1.49. Now, you'll see as we move down here, the adjustment gets smaller, and that's to adjust for economies of scale. So the larger your student population, the more efficient it should be to operate that school. So here we have the elementary school, I believe it is. We have 444. We subtract 400 from that. The remainder is 44. We multiply that times 0.92, which will give you 40.48. We add that to the 471.60, which will give you a total of 512.08. For the high school, we have 340 students. Here again, you can look up here in the table. It's 250 to 400, line 6. The formula is subtract 250 from the 340, which would give you 90 students, times 0.97 will give you 87.30. 87.30 added to the 326.1 will give you the 413.40. And then once again, here's the youth facility with 14 students. It falls in this range of 1 to 20. It simply gets 39.6. Now, as you may remember, I said about Kodiak that when they had the 7 kids in the one school below 10, when we added that to the 10, they only had 17, so they didn't get any additional funding for that one very small school. And I have to tell you, the formula restricts the revenue to school districts on that have fewer than 10 students in a school. So in essence, it encourages them to close the school. The state does not close the school.
Oh, and Eddie, so I thought that they had to close it if there was less than 10 students.
Madam Chair, they do not. They can keep it open. And in many cases, the school districts will work with the communities. They'll give them a grant, they'll grandfather them for a year to see if they can get that student population back up.
Actually, in NACNEC, across the river, there's 8 students and a teacher, and it's cheaper for them to fly those kids back and forth every day than it is to have the school, to run the school. So they fly the kids back and forth every day. Representative Seaton.
Thanks. Eddie, in something that we were doing with boarding schools in Galena, we had a provision in there, if the kids left the school and it took down below 10, it wouldn't change either the formula, or wouldn't close the school, wouldn't be, but apparently we're not closing the school anyway. But did that maintain the formula at the base? Is that what?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, you're referring to the boarding school bill that passed last year. And there was contained in that bill during the debate a provision that would hold schools harmless if they fell below 10. That provision pulled out in that legislation, so it did not pass. There is no hold harmless for that.
Okay, thanks. But again, may not be hold harmless, but the state doesn't mandate the closure of the school. It's just that they
through the chair,
less funding.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, we do not mandate the closure of that school. That's a district decision.
Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does that mean you extinguish all funds because that range is from 10 to 19.99? Or would you still allocate a formula based on 8 students?
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, that the way the statute's written right now, if you fall below 10, we add you to the smallest school in the district. The intent is, or the belief is, that the next smallest should be more than 20, so you're going to get some funding for that school. But I have to tell you, at that level, it's not enough to really maintain the school on an ongoing basis.
Right, but you, if I might.
Go ahead.
You still allocate some money to that school.
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, in most cases we do, but as I gave you that one example in Kodiak, it has happened that they didn't get the money, get additional money.
Thank you.
Very rare case. Okay, I'm going to back up here. So you can see here as we went through the adjustments for the elementary school, the high school, the youth facility, the adjusted ADM for the known public schools for school size is 956. The next step is to apply the district cost factors. When Senate Bill 36 was passed, there was a requirement that the Department of Education review the area cost differentials and make recommendations back to the legislature for adjustments. We attempted to do that in 2001. The methodology that was utilized to establish the cost differentials was no longer valid. We did an internal analysis. We ran it back by the McDowell Group, who had developed the cost differentials. And they concurred with our assumption that you cannot use their methodology again. So the department asked the legislature for funding to commission a study. The legislature appropriated the money to themselves, to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, and commissioned a study under with the American Institute for Research, a research agency out of California. They submitted their report to the legislature for consideration. There was lots of debate that year over the results. And the legislature then contracted with the ICER group out of the University of Anchorage, or University of Alaska. The peer review said the methodology that they utilized was sound, but some of the data that they used wasn't good data, or they didn't like the way that they applied it. So the legislature then contracted with ICER to use that same methodology but change the components that they didn't like and then come back to the legislature with new cost differentials. That was done 2 years ago, I believe. There was lots of discussion about implementing 100% of the cost differentials, a portion of the cost differentials. And as it ended up last year, the legislature did pass legislation that implemented a quarter of the increase in the cost differentials that were recommended by ICER for a one-year period. And the cost of that was approximately $24 million. The governor did include the $24 million for that component in her budget, but school districts are going to be it will be a grant determined on the amount that they receive this year. So it's a little bit different. What we did last year was this year in '07 was we have new cost differentials for 1 year. The statute requires us to revert back to the old differentials after this year. And so we have to calculate the difference. So if I'm a school district and I benefited by $100,000 this year by that adjustment, I would expect to get a $100,000 grant next year as it's currently proposed in the governor's budget.
Representative Newland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Eddie, I'm just trying to, when we were playing that debate on the House floor last year when we were looking at 13, and we were talking about that, and wasn't it Representative Schnault, when that came through, wasn't that a $40 million increase? How come that number's sticking out in my mind?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, actually it was $35 million. There was two pieces to it. The first was $24 million for the cost differentials, and then there was an additional $11 million allocated for school improvement grants, which was the equivalent of an $81 grant per child.
Representative Edgman.
Heating costs or the cost of fuel. What kind of factors that play in these district cost factors? And I ask that because I've looked at some of the numbers statewide. And I know we pay for heating fuel in my community, and the number is smaller in that community vis-a-vis other communities where heating fuel is a lot cheaper.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, that the heating utility costs are a component of the cost factor. When the American Institute of Research did their cost model, they actually developed prototype schools and had it broken down by regions of the state. And when the ICER group looked at the results of that costing model and compared that to what the actual energy costs were across the state, they were far, far apart. And so as part of the updated study that the ICER did, they used actual energy costs as their gauge or indicator.
And that's 2005 data?
I think it might have been 2004. I think it was 2004.
And I think when they came up with some of that, some schools are better insulated than others. So even though the cost of fuel is different, what it costs the school sometimes might be totally different, even though one pays more for the fuel because they're better insulated. So there's all kinds of factors in there that they had to look at.
Okay.
I represent Seaton.
I remember my question. So in the governor's budget, the cost differential as being a set dollar amount, that means if the base student allocation goes up, those percentages that were allocated to districts will not include any relationship to that base student allocation, the new base student allocation. Is that basically the reasoning for that it'll be the dollars from last year, not based on any new base student allocation?
Through the chair, Senator Seat, or Representative Seaton, I believe that's correct.
Okay.
The cost factors are specific to each school district. They're set in statute. They range from 1.00, and the highest is 1.736, and that would be the Aleutian Region School District out on the chain. So here you can see we start with the adjusted average daily membership for school size of 965. The cost factor for Nome is 1.319, so our new adjusted ADM is 1.272. The next step is we take that product and we increase it by 20% for special needs.
Before you start on that, I want to go back to that. I can't remember, but this district cost factor, that list of numbers that is used, that's used for other things in state governments too. And I can't remember, but I know one of them is for daycare centers to get paid by the state if they have a child that is qualified for the state to pay. They're based on that. So some regions get more money. I know there's other things, but I can't think of what the other things are. Do you know what those are?
Madam Chair, I do not.
Okay.
I do know there are other programs that utilize our cost differentials.
Right. And so this not only is a factor with the school system, funding for the school system, but it's also a factor in funding other parts of state government.
Okay, so the special needs funding is a 20% block grant, and it's intended to assist school districts with special education, vocational education, gifted, talented, and bilingual, bicultural programs. And to qualify for the funding, school districts had to submit a plan that indicated how they were going to provide those services. All school districts complied with that requirement in 1999. So here you can see for Nome, we start with the previous product of 1,272. We multiply that times 1.20, and our new product is 1.527. And you'll see right here at the bottom of my slide, it says shown on column R, page 8. At the back of this handout, we have two pages of spreadsheets, and you'll see that these adjustments are listed on there for you. So you can follow those for your school district as well.
Madam Chair.
Representative Seaton.
Thanks. Eddie, the block grant, they had to submit a plan. Is there a follow-up from the Department of Education that they break out the money and fund all those things, or is there follow-up from the department on that?
Through the Chair, Representative Seaton, there is follow-up in terms of compliance with the federal IDEA. Individuals with Disabilities Act, compliance with that. We do not require districts to split up this 20% block and say they're going to give so much to voc ed, so much to bilingual. That's all a local decision. So I should say, as we go through the foundation formula here and all these different adjustments, when you get to the bottom line, how much state aid a school district receives, that's discretionary money. That is up to the local school board to determine how they're going to use that money to educate the children within their community.
Eddie, what happens? I know there's school districts that really have more than 20% special needs children. So what happens there?
Madam Chair, they would use other resources generated through the foundation program if that's what they need to do.
So there's
and Madam Chair, I'd like to say I've heard lots of arguments that the 20% is not enough. On a statewide basis, the 20% provided about $4 million more than the previous funding formula when we actually had categorical funding and students were labeled to generate revenue. On an individual school district basis, I'll tell you, some don't get as much as they used to, and others get a little bit more in this category.
Representative Farrakhan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm brand new, so it'll be a question that you can give me an up or down response on. For a larger urban district, I represent Anchorage, Chugach, Eagle River, elected from that area. Does a multiplier of 20% help or hurt that particular district because the school size is higher versus lower? I said up or down. I wanted like a yes or a no. I mean, there's got to be an impact. Generating more dollars because it's multiplied times per student, but Anchorage is more of a magnet or a hub for special needs students, and the district is having to provide education facilities for basically quite a few rural students at this point, where people are bringing their families or those particular children into the urban area to receive the benefit. So
I understand what you're saying, Representative Fairclaw. This is a hard one for me to answer because many districts have argued that the 20% isn't enough, and I think you'll find quickly as you move through the legislative session, typically what happens is the legislature determines how much additional money they're going to provide. And I've done many analysis on this component and compared it to what happens if you put the money in the base student allocation or if you increase the 20%. It's almost a wash on either side. So if there's $50 million additional money the legislature's willing to put in, quite frankly, it doesn't matter if you do it at this point or if you wait and do it on the base student allocation.
Let me, if I might, Madam Chair, ask it differently. It sounds like you've been through several cycles of change in foundation formula. So when we went to a 1.2 model factor for this formula, did Anchorage lose or gain money under the special education category?
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, I'll get that information to your office. I can't say Anchorage did better or worse.
And just a statement on that, I'm not trying to take money from anyone. I'm just trying to determine which way special ed is going as far as the funding factor goes, not try to take money from anywhere else or give it to anywhere else.
I understand that and appreciate it. And just so you understand where we came from, we used to have four different special education categories under the previous formula. Based on levels of service. We used to have five different categories for bilingual bicultural students, and then we had one category for vocational education. And actually, when the formula started, there was four, but then they consolidated it to one under VOCAD. But what was happening under the old funding formula was we had a relatively stagnant student population, but the bilingual bicultural category was going up, up, up each year, and the special education category was going up, up, up. And the legislature wasn't providing additional funding through the, I'm gonna call it the base student allocation, but it was a different formula back then. So there was a perception, whether it's true or not, there was a perception that districts were labeling children to generate revenue. And so there was this very long, heated discussion about going to this 20%. The state board started that discussion. The legislature had it, and this is where we ended up.
Follow up, Representative Faircloth.
Actually, looking to the committee for support as well as to the department, Representative Wilson, you talked about heat, and you know I understand different homes generating different expenses. It also has to do with how we maintain those facilities and what kind of insulation if you put R1 or R11. And so should, and this is just throwing out so that you can help me understand, should we keep letting a person or a facility that leaves all of their windows open to create an airflow for the students, which sixth graders need oxygen in those small rooms, I know that. But it causes increased oil costs in rural Alaska versus an urban school that might have those down and be running air conditioners. And so the same thing can be said for special education, that depending on the model that we choose to deliver for special education in urban Anchorage, it could cost a lot more or a lot less than in rural Alaska. And so, you know, I'm sure there's middle grounds and look forward to hearing a discussion so that you can enlighten me on the way that flexes inside the system.
Well, and you know, and there's some schools that don't even speak English until the third grade. And so,
and how do we honor those things?
Yeah, and you know, and so that's the whole school would be 100%, you know, instead of 20%, you know, eventually. So it's all up
in
the
air. This is the formula we've adopted, and yep. I just want to understand how it flexes back and forth.
Yeah, Representative Newman, you're next, and then Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a little bit on that discussion Representative Faircloth brought up is, I somewhat liken it to the fact of the district cost factor discussion in a way, because every school is mandated to provide for special needs, but Representative Wilson's school in Wrangell or some of her smaller districts, you know, where they have to fly them, those schools also have to provide for those needs, but they don't necessarily have the capabilities in their communities to provide for those needs, where Anchorage has a larger professional population base to help provide for the special needs students with different types of instruction and people available to help with those needs, where a lot of the smaller school districts, very small school districts in some cases, the personnel that may be available for that. So, and again, I think I can see it more where Eddie's coming from, where it's kind of a wash at times because it's kind of a mock mixing.
And sometimes it's who, it depends on who's looking at it, whether they think it's fair or not, obviously. And with a smaller school, maybe they can't afford a speech therapist and a physical therapist and you know, whatever. And so they, when they come a couple times a year and maybe they fly them in or something, I mean, I don't know how, every school does it different. And so it just costs more to do it one way, but you can't afford to have a full-time person, so what do, you know? So, Representative Seaton, did you want to follow up?
Thank you. I just was going to say I do understand the differences. I used to live in Unalaska and was honored to be flown on a basketball team, which I thought was very extravagant, but it really was the only activity that the six students sort of engaged in. So there is different cost, yes, factors on why you deliver, yeah, a basketball program a particular way. That's the only other students that I interacted with in my high school, those high school years, you know, being flown out four times to go to Sandpoint or something to engage. So, you know, I recognize that and look forward. I'm just intrigued but that we actually have a formula, and I can't believe that, you know, 60 people got together to hammer it out, and I'd like to know all the factors that
it was
went into making that, constructing that. I can just see that construction visually.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, I think that's right. I don't think all 60 were together on that.
I'm considering a house.
There was 60 votes.
But, you know, there is one other factor, like with the fuel, and that is that in rural schools, the state is responsible for building the schools. And so if we've got schools that are uninsulated and are basically not up to the standards that we would like to see for insulation, in some ways, you know, it's our fault. And so those are all the complexities of this thing comes together with also who's funding the facilities. So thanks.
Go ahead.
Okay. Before we leave the 20%, though, I'd like to point out that this system is different from the old one. As I mentioned earlier, we had the different categories. Students had to be receiving services in those categories. The 20% is applied across the board to all children after we do the school size, after we do the cost factor. So as I mentioned before, when I did the analysis between the old formula and the new formula, there was actually about $4 million more going through this mechanism than there was under the previous. Intensive service funding, this is the one special education category that we've broken out separately. For a school district to receive funding under the intensive service category, the students must be receiving services. It is a one-day head count on the last day of the 20-day count period. And obviously, the student has to have an active IEP that identifies those services. And an intensive student generates $26,900. That's what the equivalent of five times the base is. So we take the student count times five. And in this case, for Nome, they had four students in this category. Times five is 20. Again, we add that to the previous product. Now we're up to 1,547 adjusted ADM for Nome Public Schools.
Eddie, does that mean, I mean, is this basically anybody that has to have a one-to-one or?
Madam Chair, pretty much it's one-to-one. It's your severely, typically multi-handicapped children requiring a full-time aide.
Okay, and do usually, can they get somebody for that usually?
Madam Chair, clearly, that can be difficult to do. The State Board of Education did just recently amend their regulations that would allow up to 3-to-1. So there's a little bit of flexibility there. But we do have other criteria. And for example, students have to need assistance in daily living skills in two areas. To fall into this category, they need special transportation services. There's six or seven categories that they have to meet in all seven to qualify for this funding.
Just want you to know that Representative Chenault has joined us, but You're welcome to come up and bring your chair, but... Okay, Representative, who was, had their hand raised? Representative Faircloth.
Help me understand. It seems like we just went from apples to oranges. If it costs five times the amount to educate a special needs student...
Intense needs.
Intense needs students, and we identify four, we're giving them $5?
No.
Representative Faircloth, that the formula says we adjust each of those students times five. So, as I mentioned on the previous slide, each one of these children that's identified generates an additional $26,900 because of the high cost to provide educational services to these children.
Right. So, so I'm dropping to the formula, and I see 4 times 5 equals 20. It looks like $20 is being added to the base.
20 students.
Every daily attendance.
See, they get to count that for as if it was 20 more students.
So I'm lost back with where Representative Gardner was with a 0.53 student. That's why I thought that was a dollar allocation. So now we've got 1,527 students that we're adding 20 students to?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
Times the formula.
Representative Seaton, and then, okay, Representative Gardner?
So basically what we're saying is that we treat each intensive needs student in terms of funding as if they were, each one was five students.
Right.
Correct.
And basically that's because lots of times it has to be a one-to-one and you have to have an aide, especially with that child or something. So I didn't realize that they had changed that to 1 to 3. So. Go ahead.
Representative Faircloth, that what may help you is on page 8 of the funding overview that I was describing. Mm-hmm. This is basically the adjustments for student counts. All we're dealing with at this point is student counts. And when we get over here to the far right-hand side, we arrive at a number that's called the adjusted average daily membership for the school district.
And every school district is going to end up being probably different.
They are all different.
Okay.
And then on page 9, we start talking about dollars.
I followed you all the way up. I just switched to dollars about 2 slides ago. That
okay.
I thought we were calculating dollars.
Not quite yet. Not quite yet.
Still in calculating a student population.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, the last step in the adjustment for the student counts is the correspondence adjustment. Each child that's enrolled in a correspondence program is funded at 0.80. And in this case, Nome has 6 students enrolled in their correspondence program. So 6 times 0.80 is 4.8. We add that to the 1547, and we're up to 1552. Now we have the district's adjusted average daily membership, which is 1,552 times the base student allocation that's in law. 5,380. So the district's basic need is $8,351,535. As I told the Senate committee, this was lined up really nice on my computer, but I hope your slide is better in the handout. You can see here we start out with 804 students in Nome. Once we go through the size adjustment, we're up to 965. We increase that by the cost factor to get us to 1,272. Increase that product by 1.20, get you to 1,527. In this case, we add the 20 for the intensive to get you to 1,547. Then we add the correspondence adjustment of 4.8, will get you to 1,552. We multiply that times the base student allocation of 5,380 to get you to the basic need of 8,351,000. Now we have basic need, and the big question is who pays for it? And we have 3 sources of revenue that are considered under basic need. The first is the required local contribution for municipalities. We have federal impact aid, which is, we'll get into that in a minute, I guess. And then whatever's left over is your state aid. the amount that's paid by the state of Alaska. I want to spend a little bit of time on this next slide. Senate Bill 174 changed the way that we calculate required local contributions for school districts. And basically what it said is it established 1999 as the base year. And it said any increases in the full and true value over that base year, we're only going to count 50% of that increase. We've been under this provision for 7 years now. And this, I have to tell you, this flew through the legislature because the first year it was a pretty small dollar amount. It was $3.6 million statewide. Today, the impact of this provision is $50 million in FY08.
Eddie, will you?
$50
million. will you say in plain English what that bill did? Just in plain English, communities that were really growing fast, what happened? I mean, in plain English, what does it mean?
As much as I can. Basically, what this bill does is as communities are growing, have more property value, it's only going to count 50% of that growth. So those, it's basically a taxpayer subsidy is the best way I can describe it. Those communities that aren't growing are still held at the 4 mil required local contribution. And I'm going to take you through the actual calculations, how we get there in just a minute on how this is applied. But if it's all right with you, Madam Chair, I want to continue to talk about this in some general terms that I think will help people understand. And I don't want you to think I'm picking on Matt Subaru, because I'm not, but they are the extreme on one end of this spectrum. And then we have areas like Lakin Peninsula and Bristol Bay that have seen are struggling economically with the downturn in the fisheries out there. And so basically what happens is, since we count in the Bristol Bay borough, their property value hasn't gone up. So we still use basically the value that was back in 1999. And we apply a 4 mil levy to that. Yet in the Matsu borough, it's been growing tremendously, as we all know. And we only count half of the increase that they've enjoyed over that 7 year period. So when you calculate what the required local contribution is under the program compared to what their full and true value as set by the state assessor is, Matsu contributes the equivalent of a 2.8 mil contribution, while Bristol Bay contributes 4. Now, if you're not sure exactly what a mil is, for example, on a $100,000 home means you'd pay $100 in taxes. So in the Matsu borough, your $100,000 home, you're paying the equivalent of $280 to support education. In the Bristol Bay borough, the Lake and Pym borough, because theirs is still on the old value, the value hasn't gone up, on a $100,000 home, those people are contributing $400 to their children's education. So I think you all can see how this mechanism is working right now. And it's going to continue to grow. The other piece is, as this particular provision also applies to newly incorporated school districts. So as we have new boroughs come on board in this state, to be honest with you, I don't know how to calculate their local effort because they don't have a 99 base to go by. The legislature actually kind of overlooked that provision when they passed Senate Bill 174. And thankfully, we haven't had any new, I guess thankfully for me anyway, we haven't had any new boroughs incorporate during this time, because I really don't know how to calculate their local contribution.
And that's really a struggle for the an area that is losing students, so their amount that they're getting is less because it's based on the number of students. And they're having to pay the local contribution. You know, there's unemployment and all that kind of stuff, and so their local contribution is higher than somebody in an area that's really growing and people are building homes and all kinds of things are going on. And so, you know, there's a lot of feelings of why is it fair? Is that fair for one part of the area not to pay the full amount? And what it boils down to is the state is giving some school systems more money per child than they're giving my school system or somebody else's school system or somebody else's school system. So, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Do you recall the rationale or the arguments made at that time? And, I mean, did anything pass a red face test?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, the history on this mm-hmm. is right after Senate Bill 36 passed, there was an effort in the Senate side to increase the required local contribution for the North Slope Borough, Valdez, and at the time, it was, Unalaska. You're going to see in a minute here that the foundation program says you contribute the equivalent of a four-mill tax levy up to 45% of basic need. In other words, it sets a ceiling on the local contribution and guarantees state aid above that ceiling. The Senate was trying to increase that ceiling for those three districts. They were having a heck of a time getting it through their body. So I think the rationale behind it was if we can't get them up, then I'm not paying any more, or my community is not paying any more as our property value increases. And as I said, it was a very small, $3.6 million was a small dollar amount for the legislature to deal with, so it flew right through. But it has a compounding effect, and we're seeing that today.
Because every year goes back to that
99 is our base year, and I have to tell you, it increased $10 million last year, going from 07 to 08. It's going to go up $15 million. So you can see, I would anticipate it's going to go up another $10 to $15 million next year. So it won't be $50 million next year in 09. We're going to be sitting here talking about $65 million.
Right. Representative Seaton, and then Representative Newman.
Thanks, Eddie. That's the required local contribution, and as I remember, we had some charts that there was actually more local contribution in many of those areas than the required amount. Now, does that in any way compensate, or is it just the required amount and the state pays everything above, even if the local community is contributing more than the required amount?
But through the chair, Representative Seaton, you're absolutely right. Most municipalities contribute above the required local effort. This is strictly dealing with the required local effort, if that answers your question.
Following up, I'm trying to figure out the dimensions of the problem, whether it's, okay, it would be $50 million if the required local effort was all they did, but if they're contributing more than that, does that reduce it, or is that just extra money and the state still puts in more
through the
that
through the chair, Representative Seaton? Basically, the $50 million is a state subsidy on local contribution. If districts were required to contribute 4 mills on their full and true value today, there would be $50 million less in the foundation program, unless the legislature increased the base student allocation to redistribute that money.
In other words, it's just that those school districts now are getting by and they don't have to pay the 4 mills. And if they had to start making it, that would save the state $50 million.
Correct.
So, and following up then, if they're paying above the minimum requirement.
None of those are.
They are.
Yeah, they are.
They're all paying above the minimum.
And
some.
All municipalities are allowed to make an additional local contribution above that's required. Okay. Now, the additional local contribution does not affect their state aid. That's just additional local revenue from the municipality.
You mean they're letting, I mean, not only do they not have to pay their four meals, but they can still pay extra in other things if they want to?
Madam Chair, that's always been the case.
That's up to the 23%?
Correct. Now, Madam Chair, I'd like to tell the committee, my concern is in the uniformity, how this is being applied across the state. And I'm not saying that we should go back to four meals and free up $50 million. I mean, maybe the right solution is to go back to a uniform three meals across the board, maybe 2.5. I don't know what the magic number is. That's what you all are going to have to decide. But it seems to me that there needs to be some uniformity in this particular calculation across the state. And if it's the will of the legislature that the 45% is too low on that top end, then the legislature needs to address that as well. And you know, my office will run any analysis the legislature asks us to run on that. But what I'm saying is that the required local effort and the example I gave you in taxpayer contributions to support education on the same value of home, I'm not saying the same four-bedroom home, because we all know they have different values in different communities, but the value, that it needs to be leveled. The playing field needs to be leveled.
Representative Newman?
Just to add a little bit of clarity to a little bit of what's been discussed, we're talking about local contribution, but you're talking about minimum local contribution. Again, Representative Seaton referred a little bit to 23%, which is a percentage number that can be added above minimum local contribution. So you can add, if you're adding $100, you can add 123. Right. But again, to refer back, you had mentioned a little bit about Matsu and a 0.28, but that's a little deceiving in how that's been portrayed, I think, and the fact that unorganized areas of the state, you know, with having to do a four mil, but when you do add in your local contributions, and again, you were talking about some of the minimums, a lot of Kenai is maybe one, but one of the few school districts in the state that in organized areas that are meeting maybe the local maximum contribution. But when you look at those numbers, don't be mistaken in the fact that in the Matsu, and I can just give myself for an example, you know, paying $3,000 in local property taxes, 82% of that goes to the school district. So I pay over $2,500 a year and local contributions to the school districts, where somebody who's only paying a four mil rate in an unorganized part of the state and doesn't come close to that, you know, would be paying.
You know what your property tax mil is?
17.3. But that's added in the road service areas.
Yeah, and
also,
and you can get a real good idea if you look at LMA or Alaska Municipal League. Their folder at the back, they account for either the sales tax that some communities have and other communities don't, and the income or the mill rate for property tax. They take oranges and apples and make them the same, and that you can go right down and see which towns in the state pay the most percent per capita, and go down the list, and you can see exactly where your school fits. Or, you know, where, you know, it makes a big difference, and it's very interesting.
And I think those numbers are in the back here, aren't they? Excuse me, Madam Chair. I think those numbers are in the back here of local contribution. Again, I want to make sure that everybody understands when they're talking about that four mils, is that, you know, it sounded somewhat misconceiving where they only pay like a 2.8, you know. Actually, they pay a considerable amount of money in some districts.
Well, but the state is paying more, a bigger part of. For instance, in a school that has to, like in Wrangell and Petersburg and Sitka and Ketchikan, all of those areas, they have to pay their four meals. They don't get any extra funding from is it impact aid? I can't remember.
Right.
But they still have to pay their four meals, and they might not be as prosperous as MATSU is, and so it's harder for them. And so, I mean, that's what they're looking at anyway. I'm sure the people living in MATSU don't look at it that way, but the people in these areas look at it that way. So, Representative Faircloth.
Thank you again for the learning curve. Just to see if I understand this correctly. So we're going into a particular area, and the state is going to require a particular geographic region to contribute X amount of money. We established the average daily membership, is that correct?
Correct.
And in the end, the state says through their own formula of funding, because of how many students are there, you have to, and land valuation, we're going to pay X amount of state money back to you. And what's happening in some areas are being subsidized because they're not meeting the full, they're getting a deductive rate on their appraisal prices.
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, I think you hit it right on the head with your last statement. They're getting a deducted rate in their property values.
And someone else is picking it up.
The state is picking it up. The state is picking it up.
In a one particular area.
Correct.
And I understand the cost differentials of
yes.
why the formula is working.
Yes. And in fact, if we can just go to the next slide, I think this will help everybody understand what we're talking about here. You can see, this is Nome City Schools again. You'll see in 1999 their full value as set by the state assessor. And we use the state assessor's full values for all communities, so it's applied uniformly across the state. Nome was $191 million.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
On that point,
yeah.
That's the state assessor's true value. So he doesn't calculate any local exemptions that have been provided.
Through the chair, that's correct.
So it's just based on state, which, okay, thank you.
Okay, so you can see here, Nome's full and true value in 2006 is $252 million. The difference there is $60 million. So the law tells us you can't count that $60 million. You can only count 30. So we add the 30 to the 191, and we're up to $222 million. And I call this the education full value because I don't know what else to call it. I mean, we do this calculation at the Department of Education. Specifically for the purpose of calculating required local effort. So the formula says you're going to pay the lesser of the two, the equivalent of a 4 mil tax levy. And see, and this is why I have to bring this to your attention, because now we apply the 4 mils uniformly to everybody. But what we've done is we've come up with an artificial full value. Okay? So, in this case, we apply the 4 mils to the $222 million, generates $889,000. On the other side, it says we're not going to make you pay more than 45%, so we calculate that to see what that is. The lesser of the two is the $889,000. So that will be Nome's required local contribution for education. Did anybody have any questions on that one?
What was that, Bob?
Trying to clarify that, make sure that everybody understood that through the chair. That means that when you calculate the average daily attendance or average daily number of
memberships,
that you get a dollar amount based on the foundation formula. Then they're going to subtract this local contribution, the minimum local contribution, from that amount. Correct?
Correct. Madam Chair, if I may, Representative Roses, that this is simply a deduct. The money doesn't right. come back to the education, to the Department of Education, the state of Alaska. This is a mechanism for us to arrive at how much state aid we're going to provide you. In most municipalities, they're contributing something beyond this $889,000, as Representative Newman pointed out. So we're just trying to figure out how do we get to what the state aid's going to be. Okay, the other revenue that we consider in the state funding formula is the impact aid. It's under Title VIII, and the impact aid is basically payment in lieu of property taxes for federal lands. We have the military bases in Anchorage and Fairbanks. We have the Coast Guard base out in Kodiak. where people actually live on the military base. Those are non-taxable lands. Impact aid pays the school district basically a tax effort for those students that live on base. The other big factor in our state is lands that were conveyed under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And those students generate impact aid dollars for students that live on the lands. Okay? School districts don't get money just because you have federal lands within your boundaries. The kids have to live on the lands, or the families do. In this case, Nome generates $86,000 in eligible federal impact aid. The federal law has a little calculation that we have to go through, and basically it tells us to take the required local effort and divide that by the total local contribution. And here is the reason they tell us to do this is because, as I said, impact aid is in lieu of property taxes. So if you're making a contribution over and above your requirement, the federal government wants that ratio extended over to the impact aid. They want to give you that same benefit with your federal dollars. So here in this case, you can see Nome's required local contribution, $889,000. They actually contribute to the schools $1.9 million. The ratio is 46.52. So the calculation for the impact aid is we start with the $85,000. We multiply that times 46.52. The state law says we'll deduct 90% of whatever's left over. And in this case, that gives us a product of $35,984. And this would be subtracted from the district's basic need, just like the required local contribution. So here you see that we start with basic need, $8.3 million. We subtract $889,000. We also subtract $35,000. So the state aid going to the Nome Public Schools will be $7,425,000.
Governor Seaton.
And that impact aid money went to that Nome School District. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, yes, it did. Does not flow through the Department of Education. It's just like the municipality making their payment to the school district.
Does it go to the municipality or to the
Directly to the school district.
To the municipality, or, you know, the city doesn't get it?
No, they do not.
Okay. Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm back on assessed value. On the assessed value, if your property values are going up, you receive from the base year. If you are acquiring a new population, your formula is affected in a positive way all of the time because there's not additional state aid. But if you have an economy that's downturned where you're losing population, you're maxing up to the 4% all the time.
You will be at the formula local contribution, correct?
Representative Seaton.
And that isn't necessarily on population, is it? It's based on the valuation of the district.
Right.
So if there's a big industry that comes in, even if the population doesn't grow,
The valuation could grow without an increase in population due to industry coming in.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That clarification.
Bills are bills.
Okay, there are additional funds that school districts can receive above the foundation program, above basic need. Those are the additional local contributions that Representative Newman pointed out earlier, and we'll talk about that in just a second. They also qualify for quality school grants, and then there's the supplemental funding floor. The additional local contributions, the calculation for that is the greater of the equivalent of a 2 mil tax levy, or 23% of the district's basic need in the current year. I can tell you right now, all of those school districts that are on the 4 mil local contribution, their additional local contribution will be the 23% factor. That's the way it works out mathematically. It will always be that.
Okay. Representative Roses.
Through the chair, thank you. And that 23% is based on the state assessor's evaluation, and right?
Through the chair, Representative Roses, the 23% is of basic need, has nothing to do with the valuation.
Okay.
goes clear back.
Oh, right, right, okay.
Right.
Yeah, looking,
and so,
looking too far ahead here.
That's all right. I think we're going to catch up with you just here in a second. So you can see here the 23% is greater than the equivalent of a 2 mil tax levy. They're allowed, they're required to contribute the $889,000. They're allowed to contribute an additional 1.9. So the maximum local contribution NOME can provide to support public schools is $2.8 million. The Quality Schools Grant is also listed out in Alaska Statute 1417-480. It's a very straightforward calculation. We take the number of adjusted average daily membership, multiply that times 16, and that is your quality school grant. In this case, it's $24,800 for NOME. The supplemental funding floor, I have a bunch of slides in here, and there's going to be a few of them I'm just going to skip through, but basically, the floor was a provision in the Senate Bill 36, and it was basically a hold harmless or a transition provision to help districts move to the new funding formula. And just a real brief example of how that worked. If you were entitled to the $1.1 million under the old formula, but under the new formula, under Senate Bill 36, you qualified for $1 million. The difference, the $100,000, was provided to you as transition money, or we call it the floor. NOME's a good example. They qualified for this transition money in 99, they under the old formula. In FY99, we had to run both formulas to do this calculation. So under the old formula, they were eligible for $5.2 million. Under the new, a little under $5.1 million. So their transition money was $110,000. All adjustments to the funding floor, because it's intended to be transition, are decreases. We want it to go away. The decreases occur when there's an increase in basic need, and those increases in basic need will typically occur from two reasons: increase in student population or an increase in the base student allocation. And then the second provision was if we had a decrease in ADM over the 1999 base year. We have very few school districts that really fell into that category, and part of that's because we've had increases in the base student allocation. This is just an example of how that adjustment would work, using the same $100,000 example as the starting point for the floor. Assume a school district generated an additional $50,000 over the prior year. 40% of $50,000 is $20,000. We would subtract that from the $100,000. Their new funding floor in the new fiscal year would be $80,000. So we want to see that go down. I'm going to skip that one.
How many schools are still under that?
Eight or nine. And that would be on page 9 under column 8, H. 2, 4, 6, 8, 9.
Madam Chair.
Representative Newman.
Yeah, Eddie, I think by next year we're only going to be down to like 4 or so, isn't it? 4 or 5 schools.
To the Chair, Representative Newman, it depends on what happens with the formula this year. If the legislature increases the base student allocation, I would expect it to drop down probably to 4. You can see on the schedule on page 9, I think we're a little ways out before the Chugach School District or Pelican completely transition to the new funding formula. Those are very, very small school districts with either $100,000 or a couple $100,000 in the floor left. So it'll take us a while to get those off the books.
Long time.
It'll be a long time.
Yeah.
Here's how the floor worked for the NOME Public Schools. Starting back in 99, we established it at $110,000. In fiscal year 2000, there was no adjustment. In fiscal year 01, I believe that was the first year we increased the base student allocation after the new formula was implemented. You'll see that we reduced them by their 40% represented $14,000, so now we're down to $95,000. Again, we had no adjustment in 2002, but in 2003, I know we had a big increase in the base student allocation. 40% of that increase represented 73,000. We subtract that from the 95, we're down to 22,000. Again, we had another increase in 04. You can see that the 40% represented 49,000, which exceeded what their floor was, so they're on the new funding formula now. They have no supplemental funding provided.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just for topic of discussion, I know it helped me substantially, you know, when I heard it kind of phrased. And I remember one night Eddie and I were up in my office a couple of years ago, it was probably 9:30 in the evening, hashing this stuff out. I've been real good about that. But back when 36 passed in 99, there was the opinion of some in the legislature, apparently the majority in the legislature, 36 when we're done, that some school districts were getting paid too much. And so that's why the floor was incorporated into it. Yeah, but so that all those school districts, because some school districts after Senate Bill 36 was implemented, some of those school districts received substantially less funding. But they didn't want to take all that funding in 1 year. So they said, okay, we're going to come up with a formula where each year where you have an increase in funding is deducted from that floor, it's deducting off your percentage, and that's how that floor breaks down. But the intent was so that those school districts didn't just get whacked right off at the knees when Senate Bill 36 was passed, so that, you know, it gave them time to transition to what some people felt in the legislature. They were getting too much money at the time, or more than they deserved, or more than what the new formula allowed, or however you want to phrase that. But it's kind of a different way of stating that, but that's kind of helped me understand what the meaning of the
floor. Representative Seaton.
Thanks. And just for information, we will get people coming to us if we increase the base student allocation and complain that we're only funding them for part of a student, that their students aren't worth as much because they don't get the full increase, because they're receiving this supplemental income now, and they're going to get 60% of the increase. The 40% is the floor that goes away, but they're receiving more money than they would under the formula. And so their increase is not quite as much by 40% as the formula increase is, but they're actually receiving more money than they had
in the prior year.
In the prior year, or if they applied the formula equivalently across the board. So it's, but you will find that people will be telling you that you're only funding them for, their kids are only worth 60% of something else, and it's just the fact that their extra income that they've been getting for that transition money is being decreased, and that's a mechanism for decreasing it. It's good to know that, though, what that amounts
to. I just want to echo what Representative Seaton just said, because that's a very important discussion that's been brought up, you know, in several of the meetings. But again, those students are actually receiving more, 100% plus a little bit more than and not 60%.
Madam Chair, if I may, I've been through a number of funding formula rewrites, and I'll tell you, when we went through these exercises before, the way the hold harmless worked it under the previous rewrites was we calculated the difference just like we did here the first year, but it was you got 100% the first year, 75 the second, 50. It was a very prescriptive ratchet down. I think that this particular provision has caused a lot of heartburn in the legislature, and I guess we could just consider this one lessons learned, because it would really surprise me if the legislature went down this road again.
There again, some of those schools, I assume, say we weren't getting too much, and now we're being penalized. Mm-hmm. You know, and so they're looking at it from that point of view, I'm sure.
Correct. So, Madam Chair, committee members, the supplemental funding floor thing to remember is it's always going to go down. either by 40% due to the increase in basic need or due to a decrease in student population. The components of state aid, the permanent components, first is the state aid itself, second, the supplemental funding floor, third, the quality school grants get you to a total state entitlement for known public schools of $7.4 million. And if it happens, it hasn't happened. I've been administering the foundation program since 1985. The legislature has always fully funded the foundation program. They even fully funded it in 1987, but Governor Sheffield, because of declining oil prices, did a 10% across the board reduction. It's the only one I'm familiar with. But if it happens, the statute provides for us to prorate everybody, prorate them equally. And I'm just thankful I haven't had to do it, other than that one year. Madam Chair, I believe that concludes our presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Well, I'm sure everyone understands it 100%. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just something that did help me along, and so that we can all look in our own school districts and see what's going on. On the page where it showed Nome's example, I guess it's in the second half of the book, where it somewhat looks at, if you look at page 7 in the second part, where you'll see column L-O-Q-R-T. You can refer back to pages 8 and 9, where it goes through A through W. Mm-hmm. And you can put those numbers in for your school and see exactly where your schools are at in your district. And look at those, and it really helps clarify a little bit, I think. So you can get a little bit of an idea and just maybe a little bit of sage advice. Mm-hmm. It helped me to go through that and look at it, so you can compare where your schools are to other schools and put your school's numbers exactly in there and see exactly why your schools are getting what they are.
Representative Seaton?
Yeah. Eddie, I think we identified two things in here that were problematic. One was the roading floor, and the other one was the 40 or the 4 mils. Are there any other portions of the formula that you see as, you know, I mean, everybody's going to have a philosophy, but you see as just problematic in the way we've designed the formula at this point in time?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I think this legislative body will continue to have that discussion about area cost differentials, clearly. I don't think the eroding floor is quite the issue that it used to be, because it's almost gone now. I think we do need to take a look at the intensive needs students. I really didn't touch on that, but the department has been engaged in doing audits of the school district's claims, and we're finding that there have been claims that don't meet our criteria. And so I think we're going to have to take a look at that, maybe changing that mechanism. Clearly, as I pointed out, the local effort provision needs to be taken a look at. And then I would also suggest that we look at providing a hold harmless, per se, for school districts that are experiencing declining enrollment. Representative Wilson has experience with this firsthand when she went from 3 schools to 2 schools. That the funding decrease was quite substantial, very hard for that school district to absorb. Or even like in the Kenai, as you're well aware, if you try to close a school down in the Kenai, the revenue that you lose from closing a school, it really penalizes the district and does not encourage efficiencies. But if we provided a hold harmless to allow districts to transition to that new level of service, I think that would really help. And I've drafted language for that particular component that I'd be happy to share with anybody.
Are there any other components, through the chair?
Go ahead. Follow,
that you see as problematic? I mean, you're separating out the pupil transportation. You're not including that in
through the chair, Representative Seaton, I am not including pupil transportation. I'm assuming that that would be another discussion.
Right.
Representative, are you finished?
Well, I just wanted to make sure we'd gone through any other things that you've identified that mechanically or that just aren't working well.
Within the foundation program, I think cost differentials, local effort, and a hold harmless provision for declining enrollment. Those are the three big factors that we need to look at.
Thank you.
Representative Edgman.
How about the special needs factor component? That's set at 20%, and it's my understanding that some schools have more, maybe even disproportionately, really out of whack, have a lot more special needs students and have additional costs involved with that than rural schools, for example.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, the way to address that is to go back to the categorical funding and to provide an adjustment for students based on the level based on the service that they're provided. But the legislature made a conscious decision to go to this block grant because they felt that districts were labeling children to generate revenue. I'm not advocating for one over the other. I'm just saying that's why they went where they did. And as I mentioned earlier, you can make it 25% if you want. If that generates $25 million and the legislature is only going to give you 50, then that only leaves $25 million to increase the base student allocation. So, I mean, the distribution, putting it in the base student allocation over here or versus over here in the 20%, it's really not that different.
And unfortunately, it's when if a school does do something and count a child when they really shouldn't be doing it, and we end up doing something like this because of it, it just hurts everybody, you know, in the long run. But maybe, I mean, some schools have benefited, but some schools lost out too, and that's unfortunate.
Well, I personally, I think that the block funding is a good approach for school districts because they know exactly what their revenue source is. It doesn't put the department in a compliance state to make sure that your claims are valid, and it gives them the ability to work with the revenue and budget for it accordingly.
Can you give me a for instance, if you said you're auditing and you're finding that some are claiming intense need students and you're finding out that they're maybe could have qualified as just a regular special ed student? Well,
Madam Chair, most of those, I'm going to say all those students that are being claimed for intensive are special education children.
Yeah, I realize
that. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is they don't meet the 7 criteria that we have in regulation. And really, I think it's a definition issue, you know, between the Department of Education and what the legislature thought they were paying for in this category versus what school districts see as a high-cost child.
So they just
a high-cost child to them is an intensive child. But unless they meet the 7 criteria laid out in regulation, you don't qualify for this additional funding.
Can you tell us what those 7 criteria, or I mean, you probably can't do it out of the top of your head, or can you?
I bet he can.
He wrote them.
Pretty close, but no, actually, I'd be happy to bring it to the committee at a future meeting if you'd like.
That'd be fine. Okay, Representative Seaton.
On the special needs, or was it intensive need, where it went from 3 years to 22 years, is that?
That's the category of special education when a child can enter the public school system and qualify for funding.
Okay. I know a couple of years ago we had some differentials, some school districts doing 4-year-old kindergarten, 2-year kindergarten under the school system. And is there any widespread shoehorning of younger kids into school earlier under this classification system that you're aware of?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I think we've closed that loophole with the work that we did with the legislature. So there are children that come in as 4-year-olds into kindergarten, but those children have been assessed and it's been determined that they're ready to start their educational career. But along with that is the expectation that they move to kindergarten when they're 5 years old. So I think we've closed that loophole on the two-year kindergarten.
Yeah. Follow-up, but on that three-year special education, there's not a, I mean, can, you said three through 20, through 22 years. Can districts classify young kids as special ed and then get them into the base student, into the count at 3 years old?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, it's conceivable, but they have the process, the IEP process that they have to go through. And actually, the federal law requires them to do a child find, to go out and look for children with disabilities and start providing them services at age three. Federal law requires that. So there's an entire process that the school districts have to go through. And
so this one isn't being a problem?
This one is not a problem from our perspective, no.
One more.
a little easy quickie. PERS, TERS, through the formula or not, are you going to, you know, which changes drastically what we're doing and how we allocate it to schools, are you going to provide us some kind of a breakout of doing that through the formula or not, and how that relates to the different schools' liabilities for PERS, TERS?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, are you asking for a spreadsheet that shows how the distribution would occur if we put in put $207 million additional through the foundation program versus what the district's anticipated liability is?
For that same $207 million, yeah.
Yes, I can provide you with a spreadsheet that would show that comparison. I would caution you on that again, as I always do, because now you're starting to say, I want to put money in the formula, but I want it to go for this specific purpose. And it never comes out that way. So I'd be happy to provide you with that spreadsheet. And I know you and I are going to have some more discussion about this in about 15 minutes.
Okay. So okay, that was my final question.
And
thank you.
I think I had one of my staff call and asked, if we put all the PERS and TERS into the foundation formula, it would raise the base student allocation by $1,500.
No.
Okay, 1,005. I misspoke, sorry. You had a question. I think Representative Newman was next, and then you. Okay. Representative Roses.
Just a comment through the chair. One of the disadvantages, and correct me if I'm wrong, one of the disadvantages of putting the PERS and TERS obligation into the foundation formula has to do with the school districts that apply for additional grants, and it boosts their salary and benefit percentage to a point where many of them then no longer qualify as a result. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Roses, that's my understanding, that at some point there is so much money allocated for salaries and benefits that the eligibility criteria becomes very difficult to meet.
Just as a follow-up, although this has nothing to do with the formula, my understanding is when the PERS and TERS obligation was handled the same way for the university system, instead of the state paying the obligation themselves, that the university system lost considerable amount of money in grants as well because of that same reason. So that's why I wanted to make sure we understood that.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, and I look forward to working with the committee.
All right, we appreciate it, and I'm sure we'll be asking you to come again.
You've got to say your costs are. It doesn't matter whether it's inside the formula or outside.
We're adjourned.
When you apply for grant.